This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods, an online and wholesale distributor of heritage breed meat and poultry. Learn more at heritagefoods.com.
I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Fall is finally here, so it's time to get funky and devote an episode to some of our favorite spunky microbes.
Fungi just provide this beautiful, whimsical lens on how the world works. They have so many roles. They're this strange and magical-seeming group of organisms, but they've got it all figured out.
Should you eat the cheese rind? Can you eat the rind? These are like the biggest questions.
We'll answer all of your questions about mysterious mushrooms and crazy curds. Plus, we'll give you a sneak listen to the newest season of Modernist Breadcrumbs. So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Allie Kane. Welcome to In the Sauce, a new podcast about building food brands. When we launched a line of fresh sauces for grocery stores last year, I knew we were jumping into something crazy. Haven's Kitchen is a cooking school, cafe, and event space, and learning the world of CPG and grocery has been a massive learning experience. In my efforts to get myself educated, I started meeting everyone I know and respect who could advise me on everything from production and distribution to legal, PR, and social media. Then I started having those conversations here as a podcast so that other entrepreneurs can learn from them as well. This is the story of Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Jesse Darris, founder and CEO of Darris, a full-service brand strategy and communications agency firm. I met Jesse through my friend, his very proud cousin, and it turns out he's a bit of a wunderkind in the branding world. So lucky me. Welcome, Jesse.
Thanks.
So you've helped companies like Warby Parker, Reformation, Everlane, and Lola, which we're plugging because your wife started.
My wife did start it, yep.
Awesome. And those are pretty big names.
Yeah, I mean, they are now, yeah.
Yeah, and you basically helped them figure out how to effectively communicate with their consumers.
Correct, yeah. I mean, I've been incredibly lucky. We've worked with a ton of pretty incredible founders and have had the ability to work with them since really soon after they came up with their ideas, which has been really gratifying.
So as a kid, were you a product guy? Were you a brand guy? Were you a TV guy?
Like I was a political guy.
You were a as a kid?
As a kid.
Wait, that's cool.
Yeah. Fourth and fifth grader, I was into politics.
Did you run for offices and things and like promise lunchroom cookies?
I lost for four straight years.
But
in
you
high
kept
school,
going.
But I kept going. I have a little bit of grit. Yeah.
Yeah.
My grandmother, Lola, was a pretty amazing woman and was a big politico and got me into it. I think from the time I was 7, 8, 9 years old, I would watch politics with her and watch different types of programs, and she got me into reading too.
So when you were that age, who was like your political, like who was your idol?
Oh, John Kennedy. I mean,
aww.
And I read a lot of biographies about Kennedy,
right,
and about Bobby. But also became
They were a brand.
They were, and I became enamored of the actual process, and so I was reading books they probably know 12 and 13 year olds should have been reading.
Right.
Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail was a pretty amazing one. And, The Boys on the Bus, which is this entire kind of behind the scenes about how communications works, specifically on the 72 campaign, that one.
Okay, so that's exactly. So, I mean, Debbie Millman feels very strongly about this. Like, she talks about it all the time. Like, everything that you see and feel a strong connection to, whether you realize it or not, whether you're buying it or consuming it in your body, is a brand.
Everything.
Right.
Yes. I mean, and not even really a close call. You grow up and you watch these people create movements. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many 13-year-olds, I'm aging myself, stayed home to watch the Clinton inauguration, but I was one of them.
Right.
And I taped it on VHS and watched it a bunch more times after that. But he created this amazing moment. And
I remember Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. Well, I remember that song. Like
that was one piece, but his motto, the campaign slogan was, "It's the economy, stupid," which is right. Which is amazing.
Right.
Right. And you remember the campaign slogan of the winning campaign over and over and over again, no matter how far back it goes. Right. That campaign slogan was specifically, it allowed people to be selfish in a beautiful way. Right. It was, oh, the other guy doesn't get it because he's out of touch. He doesn't even know the price of a half gallon of milk.
Right.
And I get it. And you know, you're with stupid.
Right.
and I think that's pretty incredible.
It's actually really funny if you put it in today's context. Like, people would not, you know,
it's
like
quaint.
That very much. Exactly. I guess it's quaint. And yet, like, you know, people would be like, maybe the language.
Yeah.
But so did you think you wanted to be a politician or did you think you wanted to be a behind the scenes guy building the thing for the politician?
I don't think I ever aspired to be the guy or the woman. I'd rather be the person behind the politician.
Right.
I remember keenly watching The West Wing growing up.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to be Martin Sheen. I wanted to be Allison Janney.
Totally.
I wanted to be Bradley Whitford. I wanted to be the chief of staff or the press secretary or something like that.
Did you ever read The Boy Who Became President?
No.
It's like about a fourth grader who actually runs for president, and it's actually very appropriate because he wins and then he's basically like, America, you have a problem, the fact that you elected me president. But the book is kind of about the guy behind him who's like, who just wants someone he can put in the role so that he can like win, you know?
That seemed, I don't know what that says about me as a human being, but that seemed really attractive to me to be the person behind the
kingmaker.
I don't know, hardly, but
ish.
But that was always what I wanted to do. And that was what I chased after I got out of school.
Yeah. So is that what you did in college?
I did. I volunteered. The first campaign I ever volunteered on was Tammy Baldwin's first campaign for the House.
Okay.
In 1998, I cold called potential donors.
Oh, that's what my son's doing right now.
And then I got incredibly lucky and met this professor. His name's Ken Goldstein. We still keep in touch.
Mm-hmm.
Who was starting something that became the Wisconsin Advertising Project, which, believe it or not, I think it was the first project to track political advertising on television.
Mm.
This was in 1998, 99, 2000. Right. And so my first entree into watching kind of how national press worked was we would code ads using all this money from Brookings Institution to say, you know, whether they were positive or negative or neutral and what they were about.
Right.
We could figure out based on the data we were being given how much the ads cost and in what markets they were in. And we would produce reports that became press releases that always ended up on the cover of the New York Times.
Right.
Because it was the first time anybody had ever tracked TV ad spending.
That's very cool.
Which is wild.
So that was after college?
That was during college. So I had a job with him for the better part of 3 years.
That's so cool.
And he talked me out of going to law school.
Right.
And I had taken the LSAT and gone through kind of all of that. And much to my parents' chagrin, he introduced me to a handful of people. And over the Christmas break of my senior year, I went down to Washington and met with a bunch of them.
And so you thought you were going to be doing political...
I was positive that stuff. I would at least try it.
Right.
And one of the guys that I met with actually hired me and gave me my first job. He hired me in January of my senior year of college. And
awesome.
So I graduated that May. I packed up a
drove
car.
To D.C.
My parents dropped me off on some strange stoop crying.
Oh.
5 days after graduation. And I started my career at a small consulting shop. Where I was half executive assistant and half account man.
Awesome.
Which was a lot of fun.
And then how did it change? What was the transition from that into branded product?
Yep. So I spent about a year and a half apprenticing there and then worked on a bunch of campaigns back to back. Ended up getting hired by the Kerry Edwards campaign in 2004.
Your life would have been very different had he won.
It would have been quite different.
Wow.
We lost. I had been
lucky. Warby Parker. Does Warby Parker know how lucky they are that John Kerry lost?
I think I'm lucky that Warby Parker exists, but
it's mutually. Right.
I was the state spokesman in the smallest battleground state. I mean, I was a 24-year-old kid. I came back to New York. I went to go work for a guy named Ken Sunshine. That's his real name.
Mm-hmm.
Kenny had a small but really well-known PR shop in New York. I did a lot of local politics and crisis work. I tried my hand at sports and entertainment and all of these other things. And I just happened to be here as the technology movement took off.
Right.
I met the founders of Thrillist right as they were getting off the ground, and they hired me out of Sunshine to do their PR.
Cool.
And then I got a phone call in the fall of 2008 from Neil Blumenthal, who I knew through mutual friends from growing up, and he had this idea to sell glasses online that he had come up with a few friends. And that eventually became Warby Parker. I thought it was the dumbest thing I'd ever heard.
That's so cool. So that was really, I mean, so you really got lucky. I mean, in the sense that like your first gig as your own gig was a big one.
Not even that. So I didn't search out consumer brands at all.
Right.
It wasn't what I was doing. It wasn't what I had trained at all. You know, Neil and I had a series of conversations, and I met with the other guys as well. And then they came in to try to hire us, and I talked them out of it. And they hired another firm to help them with fashion press.
Right.
And they launched the business, and it was going incredibly well. And Neil called me one day to try to hire me to help with tech and some other things they needed help with.
Right.
And so I said no again. And then he came back a third time, and I said yes the third time.
Right.
And so literally I tried to say no. And I was still at Sunshine at this point. And so the business launched in 2010. I didn't get the idea to start Daris until 2012.
Right. Okay.
And it was essentially, you know, a three-part process in my head. It was Warby Parker looks like it might be successful.
Right.
I thought it was incredibly novel the way they had started to speak to customers and speak with them.
Yeah.
And I didn't think there were firms that could walk and chew gum that could speak to consumers and then also speak to brand. And
now it's funny that everyone has to.
Yeah.
Like that's like, as they say, table stakes now or whatever, right?
I certainly thought it would be. You know, it struck me as odd that that you had to hire two firms.
Yeah.
And, you know, it costs more, and firms don't necessarily like to play nice in the same sandbox.
Right.
And they speak different languages. I thought it should be integrated pretty simply.
So how did you figure out, how did you figure out what to do for Warby?
I didn't. That's the thing. I won't begin to take, you know, credit for the genius of the guys. What ended up happening is I found myself in these rooms when I was, you know, just helping them with some tech stuff and some of the buy a pair, give a pair stuff. And the rooms were incredible. You know, it was Neil and Dave and Anthony Sperduti from Partners in Spade and Andy Spade as well. And, and I didn't know enough to be scared.
Right.
Which was really good.
Oh, the days when I didn't know enough to be scared. Yeah. That was like the best.
And so I won't pretend to have added that much to Warby. I was there and I helped execute the vision that they had. But really I was learning the entire time, and I've been learning the entirety of the time, but that really was what that experience was.
But there is a thread, right? I mean, someone came on and it was Taryn, and she had wanted to be a stand-up comic. Mm. And I was like, but there's a thread. And then Scott came on last week and he wanted to do something that it relates, you know? I mean,
you're
fourth grade loving the idea of these brothers becoming this American icon is the same as what you're doing now. So there was something in you, right, when you were in the room. I'm sure you were learning a lot, and I'm not saying you're solely responsible for Warby Parker, but clearly you were good at it. Like, you were good at...
To your point, it had very specific links to politics that I now see that I didn't see then.
Right.
Right? So in my mind, it was about as a brand, defining yourself in short, positive, highly repeatable messages.
I'm going to write that down. Short, positive, highly repeatable.
That you can build into sort of a machine, so you can tell stories over and over and over again. And then at the same time, being mindful to define your opponent.
Mm-hmm.
Very clearly define your opponent. And if you look at political races, that's exactly how political races are won. And so there are a tremendous number of similarities between brands and politicians, for sure.
I love that. Defining your opponent.
Always.
You know, because for us, I think about this a lot with the sauces,
there isn't really a brand that's doing what we're doing.
But your opponent doesn't need to be a brand.
No, our opponent is eating out. Our opponent is, in some cases, a meal kit or, you know.
So I would actually broaden it out.
Yeah.
Your opponent's time, right? So
see, thank you. We can stop the podcast now.
But we think about
that's enough for today.
We think about foils all day long, right? We call them foils. So, you know, your foil, the sauce is foil. When you look at, I was looking at the ingredient list the other day to a couple of them, and that's what was most impressive to me, right?
Yeah.
You grow up. I grew up eating. I have awesome parents. So,
yeah. No, they'll forgive you.
I grew up eating kind of the processed starch product that came on the side of, you know, and I remember when the couscous came out, the flavored couscous, that was a huge moment in our family.
Yeah, it had like the flecks of green in it. That was exciting.
And you comp the kind of shelf stabilizing products and those things versus what you guys are selling.
Yeah.
And you're doing it in a way that saves people a massive amount of time.
Yep.
Both going out and shopping and then processing all the ingredients or cooking them.
And then clean up.
Yeah. And then the fact that it's so versatile is to me also a mechanism that saves time.
Okay. Well, awesome. On that note, we're going to take a little break and then we're going to come back and you'll teach me everything I need to know about branding myself and my sauces. Good.
This episode is brought to you by Heritage Foods. Heritage Foods was founded to sell ancient breeds of livestock and poultry that were becoming extinct, largely because industrial agriculture willfully pushed healthy heritage breeds aside for more profitable, faster-growing animals. Rare heritage breeds are saved when popular demand increases and farmers have the incentive to raise them. This Thanksgiving, we encourage you to buy a turkey from Frank Reese's Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch. Frank's turkeys are 100% purebred heritage, 100% pasture-raised, and 100% antibiotic-free. Turkeys are available in 2-pound increments. You choose your size. Don't wait. Pre-order your Heritage Thanksgiving turkey today at heritagefoods.com.
Hi, I'm back with Jesse Darris, founder and CEO of Darris, a full-service brand strategy and communications agency firm. So we were just talking about knowing your opponent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the same as knowing your competition, which is a good thing that you clarified for me. And to that, I guess, going down now that road, the whole brand story idea. Like, I think my biggest problem with the sauces is that they do so many things and they solve for several different problems. And that's been the problem with Havens. I mean, I first talked to you about Havens. We do so many things. This is like, I repeat this a lot, that I get tongue-tied a lot. Those, you know, what'd
short,
you say?
Positive,
short, positive, highly
repeatable.
I can't be short. I can be positive, but highly repeatable gets a little challenging. But short is the tough one for me.
I don't think it's, I don't see it. I mean, I think sometimes it's hard when it's yours in the same way that it would be hard if it was mine to make it short.
Your website's like genius.
You're part of it. Our website has not existed.
I think your website is genius because they're very, whatever they do, they're awesome at. They're not.
The new and improved website with information on it. That was our team actually forced me to make it more robust. It was just a splash page before.
Now it's got 2 job descriptions and like a sentence.
You know, if people know us, they'll find us.
It's very cool.
But I think, again, to go back, you know, I think what you guys need to do, and I think you've done this to some extent, is to build out a hierarchy.
Yeah, yes. That's what I wanted to ask you about.
You know, there's a reason the business exists in the first place, right?
Right.
There was a kernel of an idea that formed in your head about why you were doing this in the first place.
Yes.
Right? And that should be your brand's promise. It should be the thing that sits on top. We call it the lens. And then, you know, everything else beneath it is just how you how you follow through on that brand promise in specific order, right? And,
right.
And I do think, I mean, if I was looking at what you guys are doing, I would be thinking way past sauce.
Yeah. We were told that. Yeah. I mean, that's the fun thing. When you start something new, the first thing people say are like, what's next?
Yeah.
Like, wait, I just kind of wanted to get this thing going, but yes.
But product iteration for the sake of product iteration is sort of useless.
Right.
The point is that if you were going to build a brand that had a specific brand promise.
Right. Like making cooking easier.
Yeah. So if it was... That it was easier and faster, mm-hmm. that the ingredients were always a certain type of ingredient, mm-hmm. right? Five ingredients or less, or whatever right. you want to call it. And that there was something else. I mean, from a third perspective, you could definitely put convenience in there if you want to, deliver to your door, or however you want to think about it. But the point being that whatever products you end up developing, mm-hmm. that those products fulfill those promises in order.
So going back to the word hierarchy, because I've heard about it on packaging, right? That there should be a hierarchy of ideas, like the most important thing should be the biggest or something like that. I don't really understand it 100%. My guess is that my packaging doesn't necessarily hit the hierarchy rules exactly right. But is that a concept that goes beyond the actual packaging? It sounds like what you just said is that it does. It sounds like when we speak about it in any way or put it out there in any way, that there should be sort of like, you want this to go across and then these following things a little bit.
Well, I think all communications are integrated, right? So it doesn't matter if it's on your label, on your social, in your earned, you know, experiential or physical, retail shelving. It doesn't really matter. Everything is a customer touch point, every single thing. And again, when we talk about highly repeatable, we mean that people as consumers need to see something 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times mm-hmm. for it to sink
to
in.
Click.
Women less than men because they're smarter.
Yes. Thank you for acknowledging that, Jesse. You have a good wife.
I have a terrific wife. Yeah.
And a good cousin.
She's okay too. Yeah.
So what's a brand story?
I mean, to me, a brand story should be an outgrowth of its promise.
Okay.
Right? So there are different brands that have different types of stories. Certain brands have founding stories. They offer a compelling founding story because that's organically what they offer. You can't force them.
The guy who slept on the couch story?
Exactly. Right. And then other brands, are their founding story and is less relevant, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's not as cool of a story. And so a brand story evolves around the product.
Right.
Or it evolves around a personal experience or something else.
Right.
Or it evolves around fairness.
Right.
We tend to say that, at Daris, that brands are either issue brands or price brands.
Okay. Can you explain that?
Yeah. That brands are either, they're filling some version of an information delta between what consumers think is true and what is actually true.
Okay. So can you give me an example?
My wife's brand, I think, is a terrific issue brand.
I agree.
Jordana launched Lola a few years ago. It's 100% organic cotton tampons, but it's not a tampon brand. It's a feminine reproductive health brand.
Yes.
And I have to get that right. Or
I know, like Casper isn't a mattress brand. It's a sleep brand. We get it, right.
And I remember when Jordy was doing all sorts of customer research, which basically meant talking to friends and friends of friends as she was starting to think about the idea. And there was a huge delta between what women thought was in that product versus what was in that product. When she was asking people, 9 out of 10 thought those products were made of cotton when they weren't.
Right. Wow.
They were made of synthetics, largely. And that's an information delta. And once they found out that it wasn't made of cotton, they were disappointed.
Right.
And the companies, you can tell, sort of knew they'd be disappointed because they weren't listing the ingredients on the box.
Yeah.
It's a classic delta between what people think and what's real.
So is it pretty binary in the sense that it's either an issue?
No, I mean, some brands are both. I mean, I think Everlane's a pretty terrific example of they're both, right?
Right.
Michael created this incredible concept called radical transparency.
Yep.
And radical transparency is just the promise to be honest with consumers about where the products are made, about the pricing structure of the products.
Right. And I mean, I guess that, taking out that sort of I mean, I feel like what they had written on the wall was like just taking out a lot of steps in between.
Yeah. I mean, everybody takes the middleman out of the equation, but the other part of it is, so their issue is transparency and being honest about manufacturing and price, but they also are offering products at a terrific price.
Right.
Right. How many places sell Japanese denim for $68?
Right.
It doesn't exist.
Right.
And so they're a really good example of being both. But I do believe that you should fundamentally be one or the other or both.
Right. Got it. Okay. Very cool. And I think, you know, going back to us again, because I like to do that.
Yeah.
I think part of what gets me a little confused is that, you know, our promise, even though it's sort of the same, right? We're going to make cooking easier and more fun and more creative. We'll tell that story to a 25-year-old in a different way than a 32-year-old new parent or a single dad, right? Like, they come out a little bit differently depending on the audience.
Maybe.
Or not.
I'm not sure that the message is selfish enough. So I tend to believe that all consumers are self-interested. Okay. And they should be.
Yeah,
and well, not in a bad way.
Yeah.
They want to understand what's in it for them. So you can tell them the most compelling story in the world about ingredients or manufacturing or all of these other things. But if there isn't some specific compelling reason that it helps them, they're less inclined to purchase it.
But for example, like when we talk to the younger people that work at Havens, the thing that excites them the most about cooking with the sauces, the easy, convenient piece is almost secondary to them because everything is kind of easy and convenient. To them, it's this global flavor, right? They don't get to play with lemongrass.
But those are the people that work at Havens?
Well, yeah. So they might be
slightly self-selecting.
Right, that's true.
Right? So, and why don't they get to work with lemongrass?
Well, because it's a hard ingredient to work, right? So you're saying it actually does come back to the same thing.
I personally think you can find some specific and incredibly simple thread through just about every type of consumer.
This is so good.
And so, I think what they're saying is, yeah, they get to work with an exotic ingredient. And that's partly that they don't want to, like, lemongrass is difficult to find. It's difficult to break down.
Yes.
It's difficult to cook with.
Yep.
And it takes time.
Right. So it's one step away. So the global flavors are exciting to them because it makes them feel adventurous. But what it really is that we make the global flavors easier.
Yeah, they're discoverable pretty easily. But again, you know, yeah, that's, to me, the hierarchy would be that it's easy or simple.
Mm-hmm.
It would go back to the ingredients again.
Right.
And then maybe if, again, the third bullet's the thing that I would struggle with, because I would want to think about like why that existed. A lot of times that drives your content. So for me, it would be, you know, maybe discovery is that thing.
Right.
You know, because I would feel like somebody would, you know, I would probably feel the same about discovering an ingredient like lemongrass as anybody else. I'd love to know afterwards how to cook with it.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's so cool. So a lot of, you know, I think a lot of companies like ours, especially when they're in the first sort of stages, they're really, really busy. Like we're really busy, you know, like we're all doing every single job.
Yeah.
We're in the Chobani incubator. I think you know that. And there's like 20 guys on the procurement team. And we looked at each other because like we have like a half a person, you know, like because it was, you know. So, and again, they're a $4 billion company.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that they have 20 people. But you know what I mean.
Yep.
So it's hard for us to sort of sit down and think about, you know, these questions to ask. And what are consumers, you know, how do we communicate with them and what do we do for them? And, you know, are there just some simple questions that we should all be asking ourselves early on that you can sort of tell us to do before the bus is going down the highway at 80 miles an hour?
Well, I think the first thing to understand is that the bus is always going to be going 80.
Forever.
Forever.
Okay.
When we help launch businesses, we often tell founders that the easiest thing they'll ever do is launch the business. And they look at us like we're insane.
Right.
So it's slow down, pace yourself, because it's the beginning, not the end.
Right.
And we tell them to, you know, build out the hierarchy so you could build the engine.
Right.
Right? And you could build the machine that turns out these ideas, the creative machine. The creative machine should function through a bunch of different things, whether it's, again, if it's product and product iteration and that's what you can do, terrific, and you've planned some of it out. If it's physical manifestation of brand, whether for a brand like yours, it's actually demo or using the Haven space for some specific things, whether it's other types of partnerships and collaborations that would help you find scale, whether that's a retail collaboration or whether it's chef driven or whether it's brand driven, whatever else it could possibly be. The point is, I just think you're never going to stop and be able to slow down. And so I think what you have to do is make sure that you are planning,
right?
Make sure that, that people understand that brand and telling brand story is among the most important things you'll do as you scale the business. And you need to focus strategic energy on figuring out what those stories are going to be.
I mean, it's the majority of my energy, you know, I mean, it has been for a while, but I think even more so with a consumer branded product or packaged good or, you know, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Simply because, you know, it's easier when people come to Havens, they get what it is. But now I'm going into people's houses that have never heard of Havens Kitchen. I mean, it's weird to have a product that's in people's refrigerators and they don't know that there's a cooking school.
It's pretty wonderful.
Yeah, no, it's really, it's cool. It just, I have to think about brand a little differently. I wasn't even sure whether or not to put on the package we're a cooking school at the beginning. You know, we do.
I think it's kind of great. Yeah. The fact that you're headquartered in New York is also probably helpful.
Yeah, that's, I heard that too. and so like, because what you just said, I'm thinking about like, okay, so if I'm drawing this out for a new founder, I'm making a pie chart. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, okay, there's some experiential marketing, there's some co-branding, there's some press, presumably. There's a digital strategy.
There most likely is, media. Depending on the type of business it is.
Right.
I mean, I would separate, you know, earned social, the social you do in order to attract customers, from paid and acquisition.
So paid just meaning like sponsored posts?
Yeah, sponsored posts, affiliate fees. I mean, there's a million different versions of this at this point, whether it's, you know, spending money on Instagram or Facebook or a million other channels. I think that's one part of it. I mean, there are a lot of others at this point.
So I got advice and I'm curious to see if you agree with it or not. So we are not a direct-to-consumer company, right? We're not selling sauces on, you can't, you know, scroll and buy. And so someone sort of said to me at some point that Instagram ads for me make no sense. That I was thinking of it like, no, but people like that 7 or 8 times, like people will see it. And then they'll, when they see it, when they're at Whole Foods or they see it and they're at their supermarket or on Fresh Direct or whatever, then they'll think, oh, I'll buy that. And so I was thinking the Instagram ads sort of create awareness. Her point was Instagram ads should be shoppable, like that it should be, oh, you're making a face. So maybe that's not the case.
I tend to agree with you.
Okay.
So it's not to say that Instagram ads shouldn't be actionable, right?
It'd be, but there would be no action.
Yeah. And so it's terrific if they can be. But I also agree with the idea that people need to see your brand in multiple places in multiple form factors.
Okay.
Right. So people always talk about, people always talk about the power of acquisition marketing and all these companies that have scaled on Facebook and Instagram. But those same companies are the ones who are doing New York City subway takeovers.
So can you just define acquisition marketing for me?
So the ability to spend a certain amount of money to attract a customer, and the math has to work in the sense that over a period of time, the amount you spend on the customer has to be less than the lifetime value that you can get from that customer.
It seems to me, and maybe this is a very bold negative statement to be making, but I feel like there are a lot of companies out there that have a lot of sales based on ads and getting first time. I mean, for us, it's velocity, right?
Yeah.
Like you don't ring the bell when you get a store to say yes. Mm-hmm. You don't ring a bell when someone buys the product in the store. You ring the bell like when they buy it again.
Yes.
Like that's how I ring the bell. But it seems like people on, you know, when they're paying for a lot of Facebook ads and Instagram ads and they're getting sales and sales and sales, but they're spending so much on those customers, it seems like a recipe for disaster unless somehow it flips around.
Definitely could be. I mean, I think the point is that it's hard to tell until the music stops, right?
Right.
I think we're in a period of time right now where raising money, especially growth capital, is a little bit easier and people are
From your lips to God's ears, Jesse. Right.
And people are a little bit more comfortable pouring money into things like acquisition with the hope that they'll be able to raise more money behind it.
Right.
But different founders approach this differently. I mean, different people raise different types of money. The point I was trying to make before, though, because I do think it's an important one, is I do think a lot of great brands that people aspire to be like, including a lot of our clients, do a very large mixture of things as it relates to advertising.
Right.
So they are online for sure in multiple channels. But they're also doing out of home. They're doing things like wild posting. They're doing subways. They're doing bus shelters. They're doing taxi tops. They're doing radio, whether it's satellite radio or terrestrial radio. They're doing a lot of different things.
So that pie chart needs to be big with a lot of pieces of the pie.
I think it has the ability to. And if you're pouring too much of your budget into one channel, that's a little bit scary, I would assume.
And how do you, I mean, so for a brand like ours, right? Because I do think, you know, no one's seen Sauce like this before. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a huge like consumer education piece, and which is why I'm so focused on like awareness, awareness, awareness. I don't go on Facebook, so I don't really know it very well.
But me neither. Yeah.
but it does seem like though you should be doing some Facebook ads.
Maybe. I mean, my guess is that you guys are going to be doing a mixture of social and then really just straight old school in-store. And I if I were to look at the business would you know, to me, most mimic a bunch of like the beverage brands.
Right.
You got to get into the stores. You got to, I mean, you're going to spend a lot of that marketing budget on trial.
Yes.
And that makes a lot of sense to me because you want people to taste the product and it's hard to taste it through the lens.
No, it's really, and it's interesting too, because a lot of the beverage brands that I know have stopped doing as much demoing in stores and have just started handing out bottles at races and you know, festivals and things like that. And we're always like, if we could just hand, can we go to, you know, like, whatever. I don't even know.
Go to
like,
Coachella and hand out lemongrass.
Hand out some chimney, you know, and be like, just drink, you know. So yeah, we're trying to figure out what is the best way. Because even the demos are a little challenging because we need to kind of cook a little bit. We don't want to just, you know, have them as a dip, even though that's fine.
I mean,
it really is fine.
I would probably make the case that the stuff tastes so good raw, how great would it taste cooked?
Right.
And you could show off the versatility of it maybe through some of the online stuff and show off the simplicity of it in person.
Right.
But I could sit down and game out like 10 or 15 different types of opportunities.
I'm sure that you could.
But the, you know, I think the point is that the product lends itself to be tried in person.
Right. No, and the larger point, not for our product, but really the reason why I'm asking the question isn't just for us. It is for, because the, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 people that listen to this, my guess, and you can tell me on Instagram, my guess is the majority of you are founders or starting your own things. So this is really helpful because there are so many options and there, and you really don't know what's best for your brand until, I guess, you've tried a bunch of things and you somehow measure the return on each thing. Mm-hmm. And it's tricky measuring the return on things.
Well, it changes too. So again, and I'm not an acquisition expert, so I don't want to pretend to be one. But from watching our brands, different channels work at different times. Different types of creative work at different times.
Right.
It's a lot of testing. It's a lot of iterating. It's a lot of changing. And it's having smart people think about it consistently.
Which leads me to hiring. Mm-hmm. Because, so, you know, you and I have talked about this. We've never had PR. We've never, you know, I had someone help me with my cookbook for a couple months because she's great and we got along. But basically, it seems to me like it's starting to be time. Mm-hmm. And I guess the question is, what am I looking for? Am I looking for someone in-house? Am I looking for an agency? If I'm looking for an agency, what are some questions I should be asking them? What are some red flags? You know, I don't need to be like, I use this example a lot and I don't mean it to be negative, but like, what's in my bag?
Yeah.
You know, little blurb in a women's magazine isn't going to really do much, I don't think, for my business.
Yeah.
Right. So what are some things I should be looking for and how should I think about it?
I mean, the in-house versus agency thing is
and do I need it? Do we all need it?
I mean, I'm a little bit biased. I think every brand could use earned.
Yeah.
And I think that what you're talking about before was product placement. And product placement without kind of deeper storytelling isn't useless, but it's not nearly as helpful. It's the combination of the two, right? The placement driving awareness and having eyeballs see it over and over and over again, and then the deeper storytelling being hopefully more, you know, acquisitive for the brand. The two combined are pretty powerful. As it relates to what you want to do, you know, I don't know the right answer is the actual right answer. If you can find somebody who's terrific, who's a jack of all trades, who you think can grow with you, I think that would be terrific in-house.
But they'd have to be good at...
Yeah.
They'd have to understand digital. They'd have to understand like marketing. They'd have to understand PR. Like,
I think at this point in your scale, you'd be chasing a bit of a unicorn.
Yeah.
I think an agency is probably a more flexible choice and probably a little bit easier from a plug and play perspective.
Right.
The things I would be looking at,
mm-hmm.
Not to discount the founder, but the founder doesn't really matter. Right. It's totally. what the engine is that they've built.
You mean of the agency?
Of the agency. Right. Yeah. So
how do you test for that? How do you look at that?
You ask to spend time with the people who would be working on the brand.
Oh.
I mean, put simply, right, you're going to see really quickly if you start to meet the entire team, if they've hired smart people and if those people speak your language.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the things that's been most powerful about our experience is that when we started the agency, the idea, like the core idea of the business, was to hire great people and keep them as long as possible.
Right.
Because we don't have any cogs.
Right.
Our product is people and right. it's our process. And so we figured that if folks spent more time with us, learned our way in a more fluid way, and could replicate it and evolve it, because a lot of them are smarter than us, that we would be better.
That's cool.
And I do think the most important thing is spending time with the people who would actually be doing the work.
That's such a great... I don't think anyone thinks to do that. I don't think we can.
Well, it's funny when people come in and meet with us and they're like, well, how much time are you going to spend on the business? And I say, well, none.
Right.
Literally none.
None.
Like I might come to a meeting or two at the beginning and I might spend some time, and I'll spend some time behind the scenes with our guys.
Right.
But the team knows exactly what it's doing. They've been working together for so long and et cetera. And just see if you like them.
Right. No, that's so smart. That's so helpful. What about, this was a question I had, like, what about if we aren't available nationally, is it a bad idea to have national media when people can't, again, if it's not actionable, right? Like, it's hard for me to find like local media.
Yeah, there's a push and pull. I mean, I like to think if you're in more than a handful of markets and those markets are major DMAs, then you can do national.
Right.
And then it's helpful overall for the long term of the business.
And DMA?
Oh, like a media market, sorry.
Got it. DM.
Yeah. I actually don't even know what the acronym stands for.
it just means a median market. No, yeah. It's good to know. All right. Well, we have a couple minutes left. So I just want to ask you the most fun you've had since you started this whole shebang.
The most fun I've had since I started.
Like, what was like a, this is really fun moment?
I mean, that's a total cop out. I think I have a pretty severe case of undiagnosed ADD.
Yeah.
Not really. I don't want to diminish it.
I think a lot of us do.
I love being able to learn.
Yeah.
And just spending time with really, really smart people.
Me too. That's why you're on. It's true.
Thank you.
No, it's true. I think it's the key to life.
You know, people come in to meet and they think I'm like saying something interesting to them, but I'm actually just learning from them. And that is actually quite fun for me in a nerdy, nerdy way.
No, I don't think it's nerdy at all. I think the people that are having the most fun doing this are like half kind of theory geeks and half super like in the weeds practical, you know, and we kind of flip flop from both. So we're thinking about like these macro things and then we're like really in the dirt of it and we go kind of back and forth.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's, and learning from people, and a lot of people are just really experienced, and that's really fun too.
And I'm also consistently surprised at the unconnected learnings,
mm-hmm.
right? So if I learn something about an industry that literally has nothing to do with anything that I'm doing, you know, it could be about an old school retail brand, and I might find it fascinating for one of our young guys.
Totally.
There's a lot of cross pollination.
That's awesome. Would you ever write a book?
At the end.
Yeah. Do you have any working titles in your brain or chapter ideas?
No, I do, but it's going to change over time.
Well, what would be the basic thesis?
I actually have no idea. I mean, I've lived such a, I mean, for me right now, I've lived such a serendipitous life and gotten to do, I mean, I'm 38 years old. So yeah. I've gotten to do so many things that are, that were, have been amazing. I'm quite excited about what comes next, but yeah. that, you know, the idea of going from politics to this and a bunch of the stuff that happened in between is just sort of interesting. So I'm sure there's lessons in it. I don't know what they are yet. I'm not going to pretend to be smart enough. And the older I get, the dumber I realize I am.
Totally.
Yeah.
All right. So then on the final note, what is the one mistake that you would like to tell companies like mine to avoid?
The one mistake.
Or a few, but one that you see that we do that you just wish we wouldn't do.
I think the planning thing is a really big thing. I don't necessarily think that enough companies stop and have an honest conversation with themselves about what they're actually able to do in the time that they have to do it,
mm-hmm.
And aren't setting up this sort of marketing machine yep. to succeed. You can hire all the best people in the world. You can hire all the best agencies in the world. If you are not giving them things to work with or not helping them give you things to work with,
yep.
you're just going to stand in place.
Awesome. Well, here's to not standing in place. Jesse, thank you so much for coming on. I could talk to like for another hour or ask about another hour's worth of questions. And I feel like I got a really good chunk of advice. So well,
thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, it was great. And Matt, thank you for engineering, like the engineering star you are.
And I've always listened. Thanks, Matt. I wanted to thank Matt too. But you thank him every time.
I do, because, you know, without Matt, there's no
record,
podcast.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. And Maddie, thanks for doing your social. And we'll see you next time on In the Sauce.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.